When the bell rang, I was among the last to file into our classroom. Teacher Wang was already standing in front of the blackboard, writing something with a piece of chalk. Immersed in my misery, I didn't pay any attention until Wu Chunmei nudged me and pointed at our teacher's back. I looked and looked again. To my amazement, I saw my name, Yan Junling, written in big characters on the blackboard. Teacher Wang turned toward me and smiled proudly. "I want the class to welcome and salute Yan Junling as your new class president. You have elected her of your own free will. From now on, she will be the one who will lead you in reciting Sun Yat-sen's last testament in front of our flag before lessons begin. When I am called away during class, she will take charge, and you are to report to her." Everyone clapped, and I glowed with happiness. The eyes of my supporters were shining with respect and admiration. I said to myself, "How is it possible? I, the same despised daughter publicly rejected by my parents yesterday, am now being honored by my teacher and classmates. Which is the true me? Though it's blatantly obvious that my father loathes me as much as my stepmother does, perhaps he'll change his mind one day if I bring him a few more honors. Besides, does he truly hate me? Or is he just going along with her because he loves her more than me and wants a peaceful life? After all, I am his real daughter." All day, girls came up to offer their congratulations and pat me on my back. Nobody mentioned a word about being dismissed by my parents from my house. It was as if none of that had ever happened. As I basked in their goodwill, the horrors of the day before started fading. By the time I walked home, I had put those dreadful memories behind and was lightheartedly skipping along the pavement from stone to stone. I pushed open the back door and reality rushed back at once. Cook was plucking a freshly killed chicken in the kitchen. He glanced at me and called out ominously, "Sun, she's back from school." Now, why did he say that? I didn't wait to find out, but my spirits sank, and happiness evaporated as I climbed the stairs, past the Holy of Holies, where the door was mercifully closed, past the antechamber where my two half-siblings were having afternoon tea. No tea for the likes of me, of course. Never tea for the likes of me. Past my grandfather Yuya's room. Yuya was standing at his door, watching me with a sad expression on his face. He started to say something, but Ah Sun was calling out in a loud voice, "So, you're back. Tell me what else belongs to you." She was in my room, kneeling on the floor and packing a suitcase. "What are you doing?" I asked foolishly. "What does it look like I'm doing? Your Niang ordered me to pack your clothes and move you out of your aunt's room. You were to sleep on the couch in your Yuya's room tonight. Tomorrow, your father and Niang are flying to Tianjin, and you're to go with them." "To Tianjin tomorrow?" I exclaimed in dismay. "And Aunt Baba, what about her? Is she coming too?" "You must be dreaming. Your Niang says it's a bad thing you're always with her. She spoils you too much."
"But I have homework to do."
"Homework," Ah Sun scoffed.
What for, when you're flying off in an airplane at noon?
I ignored her and sat down at my desk, laid out my books, and started my homework as if my life depended on it. As I tackled my math and did my English translation, the gloom of the next day's departure seemed to lighten slightly. Ah Soon sneered at me, but I told her, "This is what I want to do on my last afternoon in Shanghai." She finished the packing and went away. I sat forlornly on the top stair landing on her floor, longing for my aunt to come home, desolate at the thought that I would never be able to go back to school or see any of my friends again. I pictured them waiting in vain for me to lead them in reciting Sun Yat-sen's last testament the next morning, and felt an overwhelming sense of despair. For once, Aunt Baba was early. From the defeated way she walked up the stairs, I suspected she knew my fate. We entered our room and she closed the door. She peered over at my homework as she peeled off her coat.
"Autumn has come early this year, and the weather turns chilly when the sun goes down," she murmured, taking my cold hands and rubbing heat into them. "Are you wearing enough clothes?"
She looked for my sweater, fished it out of the packed suitcase, and noticed a hole in the elbow. She found needle and thread and started her repair, her forehead creased in concentration. She helped me put on my sweater. We sat side by side on her bed. She removed the key from the chain around her neck, opened her safe deposit box, and took out my stack of report cards. I knew that in her eyes, my grades had been conferred an extraordinary value.
"Never mind," she said consolingly. "With such exceptional grades, you'll be able to become anybody you want. Let this be your secret weapon, your talisman, your magic charm that will bring you all the riches you could ever wish for. One day, the world will recognize your talent, and we'll leave them and live together in our own home. Just the two of us."
She didn't say how I should actually achieve this goal, seeing that I was only 10 years old and in the 6th grade and about to be banished to a Tianjin orphanage. I saw the mortified stoop of her shoulders and had no heart to challenge anything she was saying. I understood dimly how important it was for both of us to relish the dream, though I could think of nothing but the heart-rending prospect of being sent away from her forever.
"Will you always be my aunt?"
"Of course," she hugged me.
"Will you write to me every week?"
"Yes, and twice a week, if you write to me too."
"For always?"
"For as long as you're in Tianjin." She hugged me again. "And even after that, for as long as you'll remember me."
"And then?"
"After that, it's entirely up to you."
"I'll be here for you as long as I'm alive."
"Surely you know that."
"But you must never forget the dream. Try to do your best at all times."
You have something priceless inside you, which must not be wasted. I've always known that. You must prove them wrong. Promise? Yes, I promise.
Chapter 15, Boarding School in Tianjin. At Hongqiao Airport, there were huge crowds milling around, pushing and shoving like a human tidal wave, fighting for tickets. To my amazement, fewer than 10 passengers boarded our plane from Shanghai to Tianjin. I sat immediately behind Father and Yang next to an empty seat. I didn't know it then, but the China I had always known was changing before my very eyes. My grandparents, Ye Ye and Nai Nai, were both born during the Qing Dynasty, which ruled China for 374 years until Sun Yat-sen toppled it in 1911. Following Sun's revolution, local warlords divided the country into fiefdoms and waged war with one another until the emergence of the Nationalist Party under Chiang Kai-shek. When Japan invaded in 1937, most of China was controlled by Chiang. However, the communists under Mao Zedong were gaining momentum. Between 1937 and 1945, the nationalists and communists formed a united front to fight the Japanese. After Japan's surrender in 1945, the civil war resumed between Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek for the control of China. By September 1948, when Father and Yang took me north to Tianjin from Shanghai to separate me from my aunt, the communists were already in control of Manchuria and were advancing rapidly southward toward Beijing and Tianjin. Province after province was being lost to the victorious People's Liberation Army. Most people were fleeing in the opposite direction. Railroad stations, airports, and dockyards were jammed with passengers wishing to escape to Taiwan and Hong Kong. Being completely ignorant of the political situation, I merely thought it rather strange that the plane was so empty when the airport was so full. As soon as we took off, the stewardess came around to hand out landing cards.
"Are you traveling alone?" she asked.
"No, I'm with my parents."
"Good," she smiled. "Then they'll have to fill this out for you."
The airplane began to toss and roll. I felt sick to my stomach, closed my eyes, and must have fallen asleep. When I woke, Father was sitting by my side, gently shaking my shoulder. I sat bolt upright.
"Sorry, Father," I began. "Have we arrived?"
"Not yet." He had three landing cards in his hand and a sheepish expression on his face. "The stewardess asked me to fill out these cards. I'm afraid I've forgotten your Chinese name. Is it Zhongqing?" A pang went through me. I meant so little to him, I was such a nobody, that he didn't even remember my name.
"No, Father, that's little sister's name. Mine is Junling."
"Of course, Junling." He gave an embarrassed chuckle and quickly scribbled Junling on the card. "Now, give me your date of birth."
"I'm afraid I don't know, Father."
It was true. In our family, the stepchildren's birthdays were unknown. We counted for so little that our birthdays were never remembered, let alone celebrated. He scratched his head. "Let's see now. How old are you?"
"I'm 10, Father."
10 years old. How time flies. He looked into space and was lost in reverie. After a while, he continued, "But we have to complete these landing cards." "Tell you what. Why don't I give you my birthday? Would you like that?"
"Yes, please, Father."
How wonderful. To share the same birthday as my father? I was thrilled. "Now you know what to say next time when someone asks you for your birthday."
That's how November 30th became my birthday, the same day as my father's.
Nyang's brother, Pierre Prosperi, met us at the airport. I had met him once before when he came to our house for dinner in Shanghai. I didn't know where I was or what time it was, but dared not ask. The day seemed to be drawing to a close.
"Say good evening to your Uncle Pierre,"
Nyang instructed me. When I did, she exclaimed,
"Not in the Shanghai dialect. No one speaks that here."
It was true. Everyone at the crowded airport was shouting to each other in Mandarin, the local dialect of Tianjin. Outside, it was already dark. I knew I was far from home, where Aunt Baba was probably having dinner with Yaya and my three brothers. Was she thinking of me, too? Father and Yang hurried me into a big black motor car. Father sat in front, talking business with Uncle Pierre and the chauffeur. Yang and I were alone in the back seat. I smelled her perfume and was dizzy with worry and nausea. I closed my eyes and pretended to be asleep because I was afraid. We drove for a long time. When we arrived, it was pitch black. The chauffeur got my suitcase out of the trunk while Nyang told me to stand with her in front of the massive gates of a large building. It looked familiar. Where had I seen it before? The gate swung open as soon as Nyang pressed the bell. Two tall foreign nuns in starched white habits were standing at the door. They shook Nyang's hand and patted me on the head.
"We have been waiting for you," they said.
"Bow to Mother Marie and Mother Natalie," Nyang instructed, and I bowed obediently. "Sorry, we are so late," Nyang exclaimed as the chauffeur took my suitcase inside. "Behave yourself and listen to the sisters." Suddenly, I realized she was speaking to me. More than that, I was being dismissed. "Mother Marie used to be my English teacher, and Mother Natalie my French teacher when I studied here." She turned to the sisters with a charming smile. "I won't trouble you now, but will telephone you at a more civilized hour tomorrow. Sleep well." She strode back toward the car, with a chauffeur trailing behind. He respectfully opened the car door for her, started the engine, and pulled away. All this time, Father and Uncle Pierre had remained in the car, talking to each other in hushed, earnest voices. Neither of them bothered to look up or wave goodbye. I watched the taillights of Father's car disappear, and an awful loneliness sank in. They had tossed me aside like a piece of garbage. The sisters spoke in English, which I barely understood. When I answered in Mandarin, they shook their heads. "No, no, no Chinese. You must speak only English or French here. This is how you learn." They took me into a big room with rows and rows of beds, each with a curtain at its side. Only the three beds nearest the door had their curtains drawn. Mother Natalie placed a finger against her lips for silence. She pointed to the bed next to the three occupied ones and closed the curtain softly. "This is where you'll sleep with the other three boarders here. We used to have so many, and now there are only four, counting you. Tomorrow you'll meet them all. Come with me now, and I'll show you the bathroom.
It's late, and you must be tired.
Where am I, Mother Natalie? I asked. Am I in Tianjin?
She stared at me in astonishment.
Didn't your mother tell you?
Yes.
You're in Tianjin, and she has enrolled you as a boarder at St. Joseph's, where she herself went to school. She telephoned us 2 days ago and told us you had attended kindergarten here as a day girl when you were 5 years old. Don't you remember?
I lay awake for a long time, snuggled under the blankets, thinking.
No wonder those iron gates looked familiar.
So I'm back at St. Joseph's. Well, at least I'm not in an orphanage. Things could be worse. Through a slit in my curtain, I could see the shapes of the rows of empty beds in the semi-darkness. Bed after bed, with no child sleeping. Each with its curtain primly pulled back, waiting and waiting. Every one bare and sorrowful, just like me. I must have dozed off because I woke to the murmur of voices. Sunlight poured through my curtain, and I recalled with a start I was in a strange place, far from home. I crawled out of bed and nervously peered through my curtain. A girl my age was sitting on the bed next to mine, talking to a grown-up woman. They smiled at me.
Hello, the girl said in English. Did you sleep well?
Yes, I answered, adding hastily in Mandarin. My English is bad. In fact, I hardly speak any. She switched at once to Chinese and said,
I am Nancy Chen. This is my mother.
Mother Natalie says you flew in from Shanghai yesterday. Is that true? I nodded. Nancy turned triumphantly to her mother.
See? Didn't I tell you?
Oh, I can hardly believe this, Mrs. Chun exclaimed. Aren't you afraid?
No, I replied with a laugh. Afraid of what?
Didn't your parents tell you the communists don't believe in God and hate foreigners? A Chinese student in a foreign convent school is seen by them as a member of the same religious order, and will be persecuted along with the nuns if they win the war.
I could only stare at her dumbly as she continued.
What are your parents thinking of? Everyone is fleeing Tianjin for Shanghai or Hong Kong. And here you are coming from the opposite direction. Do your parents plan to move to Tianjin and live here from now on?
I don't think so. I heard Father say to my uncle in the car yesterday that they're flying back to Shanghai in 4 days.
She looked at me, horror-stricken. And they are leaving you here by yourself? All alone in a foreign convent school? Don't they read the newspapers in Shanghai? Haven't they heard the communists are winning the war? Soon, PLA soldiers will be marching in from Manchuria. When they arrive, they'll probably arrest us capitalists along with the foreign sisters and put everybody in prison. Thousands of refugees from up north are pouring into Tianjin every day to get away from them. Oh, it's almost impossible to get a plane or train ticket out of here. We've been waiting for 2 months. Suddenly I remembered the chaos at the airport the day before and could only suck in my breath, sick with dismay. Then she said, "What have you done that your parents should wish to punish you like this?" My new school seemed so different from my old school in Shanghai. To begin with, there were fewer than 100 pupils in this enormous place meant for 1,000. We were divided into 6 classes,
depending not on age, but on our ability to speak English. To my embarrassment, they placed me in the beginners group. My classmates ranged from 5 to 8 years old, while I was almost 11. It was as if I'd never left kindergarten. Instead of algebra, I was doing addition and subtraction. We were not supposed to converse in Chinese with each other at any time, so I said nothing at all unless the sisters addressed me by name. My classmates probably thought I was dumb because I was so much bigger, but never raised my hand or volunteered to answer any questions. In English conversation class one day, Mother Marie pointed to me to stand up and read aloud from Grimm's Book of Fairy Tales. My mouth was dry, and I knew my accent was terrible. Mother Marie mimicked my pronunciation, and everyone snickered. Finally, she asked, "How old are you?" 10. "How do you feel about coming to school here?" I looked around at my classmates, all of them smaller, younger, smarter, and fluent in English. "I feel old," I told her.
"You mean like having one foot in the grave?"
All the girls chuckled. I looked up the word grave with a fury of concentration in the English-Chinese half of my dictionary. Then I made a quick search for two other words in the Chinese-English section.
"Well, as I was saying, do you feel as if you have one foot in the grave?"
"Yes, and my other foot is on a piece of watermelon rind." There was loud laughter, and a twinkle came into Mother Marie's eyes.
"So, we have a comedian here. Tell me, what is your favorite book?"
I held up my dictionary.
"This book here. I can't live without it."
Everyone laughed, including Mother Marie.
"And if you could have one wish granted, what would that be?"
"To receive a letter addressed to me. Just one letter. From anyone." Nancy Chun left Tianjin with her mother in the middle of November 1948. By then, the number of students had dwindled, and we were all gathered into a single classroom, ranging in age from 7 to 18. Every morning, fewer girls would show up than the day before. One by one, they vanished, many without saying goodbye. By the middle of December, I was the only student left. 3 days before Christmas, Mother Marie gave me an assignment. I was to learn by heart a poem called A Visit from St. Nicholas. I didn't like the poem. It was too hard. I looked up all the complicated English words and translated them into Chinese, but the poem still didn't thrill me. When I recited it, Mother Marie asked, "Who wrote it?"
"Someone called Clement Clark Moore."
"Really?
I wouldn't have guessed in a million years.
Clement Clark Moore is probably turning over in his grave. It sounds like nothing I've heard before. I thought you were repeating a Chinese poem."
I didn't feel so bad because she smiled while saying this and patted me on the head. Besides, we were all by ourselves in the classroom, and there was no other student there to laugh at me. Mother Marie was nice, but she seemed at a loss as to how and what to teach me. In fact, all the sisters appeared somewhat bewildered and avoided looking at me directly whenever they happened to meet me in the corridors. They themselves darted around aimlessly all day in their black and white winter habits, silently clicking their rosaries. The atmosphere was eerie and strange. Our days were numbered. The communists were coming. Everyone knew, but nobody talked about it. Day after day, I would wander by myself from classroom to classroom because there was nowhere to go and no one to play with. I hated being by myself and missed my schoolmates terribly. All the rooms were empty. Rows and rows of desks and chairs and nobody anywhere. I would look at the whitewashed walls hung with maps of China, Tianjin, and France, stand in front of the blank blackboard filmed with chalk dust, stare at the crucifix above the door, sit at a desk scarred by thousands of cuts and pencil marks. The place had become a ghost town. Once I wandered into the chapel after lunch and found it full of praying nuns. Apparently, this was where the sisters were spending most of their time. I knelt in a pew and looked at the majestic vaulted ceiling. The statues of Jesus and the Virgin Mary radiated a special tranquility as they peered out from the candle smoke and incense vapor floating upward. I dared not breathe too hard for fear it would all be blown away. Someone started playing the organ. The music enchanted me. For a few minutes, I felt safe again, the way I used to on Saturday nights in Shanghai, when I would snuggle deliciously in bed for hours and hours, knowing there was no school the next day. Once more, I saw Yaya and Aunt Baba playing cards by my bedside. Everything was cozy, relaxed, and comfortable. My aunt's hair was combed back smoothly into a bun that glistened in the lamplight. I heard again the rhythm of her voice, intermingled with Yaya's laughter drifting across the room. What wonderful, soothing sounds! Then she tucked the blankets around me and lowered the mosquito net over my bed. On Christmas Day, I ate dinner all by myself in the vast refectory. Sister Elaine brought me an enormous plate of ham, beans, and potatoes. Meanwhile, she was rushing in and out distractedly, bringing in one thing at a time. Bread, water, butter, applesauce, salt, pepper. But she had neglected to give me a fork, and I had nothing to eat with. One minute, she seemed glad I was still around for her to fuss over. The next minute, she'd forgotten all about me, after saying she would bring me hot Christmas pudding for dessert. I sat for ages, pushing my food around on my plate. Outside, I could hear the sound of a phonograph scratching out the sweet refrain of Silent Night, sung by an unknown soprano. I put my head against my folded arms on the refectory table and fell asleep. Later on that evening, I wrote to Aunt Baba. Dearest Aunt Baba, I have been trying to think of what I should say to you because I don't want to worry you, but there is no other student in the school now except for me. I'm the only one left. Just me and the sisters in this enormous place. Sometimes I can't help wondering what's going to happen when the communists come. Will they take me away with the sisters and put me in prison too? It is impossible to describe to you how I feel. I have written to you so many, many times, and to Yaya and third brother too. So far, there is no letter from anyone. Why don't you write? Why doesn't anyone send me a letter? I want you to drop me a line when you get this. I can't imagine why you don't reply. You have no idea what it's like. To be all alone here makes me very, very sad. At night, I lie awake for a long time and stare at all the other empty beds in my dormitory, laid out next to each other like little tombs. I want you to send me your photograph so I can place it by my bed. I would give everything in the world to be with you and Yuya again, back in Shanghai. Don't forget me. Day after dreary day went by. New Year's came, and it was 1949. There was nobody to play with and nothing to do. The sisters were far too busy to fuss with me. Every day was a free day. I spent a lot of time in the library reading fairy tales. Mother Marie had given me a book for Christmas called Paper Magic, Playing Solitary Games with Paper, Origami and Paper Cuts. Hour after hour, I learned how to fold and cut paper into airplanes, ships, flowers, monkeys, and birds. I loved this book because my troubles seemed to vanish when I applied its magic. I didn't dare ask Mother Marie too often whether I had any mail because the answer was always no. I didn't know then that Nyang had instructed the nuns to stop all my incoming and outgoing mail and forward it to her instead. "Look, there is no point in inquiring any more," Mother Marie told me one day. "Believe me, if you get a letter, I'll shout it from the rooftop and bring it to you at once. Even if you're asleep, I'll wake you up." Then she looked embarrassed and gave me a piece of candy she took from a small gold box in her pocket. "This little snuff box is the only thing I have to remind me of my father," she told me. "He died in Nîmes 3 years ago. So you see, we all suffer in one way or another. Let us pray for each other." In her voice, I heard sadness and fear. I was bouncing a ball against the wall in the schoolyard, sending it as high up as I could and jumping up to catch it. I saw Mother Marie huffing and puffing toward me. She was waving her right arm and yelling, "Adeline! Adeline!" The French nuns at St. Joseph's School called me Adeline, not Yan Junling. Was it lunchtime already? I glanced at her as I bounced the ball hard one last time. Back up it went. I tried to catch it as it came down, but it landed on my head. It hurt a lot, but I didn't want Mother Marie to notice, so I acted as if it were nothing. What was she saying?
"Adeline, your aunt is here to take you out of school. She is sailing to Hong Kong next week and wants to take you with her."
My heart gave a giant lurch as her words sank in. For a dazzling moment, I knew with every fiber of my being that somehow, against all odds, Aunt Baba had come to my rescue. The whole of me was vibrating with joy, and I ran as fast as I could toward the visitor's lounge, followed by Mother Marie. I stopped abruptly at the threshold. In front of me was a small, mousy foreign woman with dark brown hair, dressed in a Western suit. There was no one else.
"Adeline,"
she smiled and greeted me in English. "How big you've grown. Do you remember me? I am Aunt Ren Shilling, your Nyang's older sister." I smiled back shyly, saying nothing. A black wave of disappointment swept over me.
"Come here. Don't be afraid. The last time we met, you were still in kindergarten. It must have been 6 years ago, when your Nainai was still alive. You were only 4 or 5 years old then. No wonder you don't remember."
Something came over me. Great waves of anguish swelled up. I tried again and again to greet her, to be polite and say how grateful I was that she had come. Words choked me as I struggled, silently cursing my poor English. then, to my great embarrassment, in front of Mother Marie and the stranger, I started to weep. I hardly knew why I was crying. For the last few months, I'd taken the blows as they came, with stoical fortitude. The pain of being torn from my aunt, the anxiety of seeing all my schoolmates disappear from St. Joseph's, the perception of being abandoned and forgotten, the fear of being imprisoned by the communists, the knowledge of my teacher's own terror and helplessness. Of course, I had no words to describe any of this. Somehow, it was still desperately important to put up a front and keep up the pretense. Besides, Aunt Wren was stroking my hair and telling me not to cry. "Hush now, hush. Everything will be all right. It's a good thing your parents mentioned you were enrolled as a boarder at St. Joseph's when they dined with us in September. Otherwise, how would we have known? To think we might have left Tianjin without you. Now you can sail with us to Hong Kong next week. You can share a cabin with me and my daughter, Claudine. She's 9. My husband, Jean, will share one with our son, Victor, who is 10. Your parents will be so pleased to see you. They fled to Hong Kong 3 months ago with Yaya and your younger brother and sister. For the first time since my arrival in Tianjin, the sisters allowed me to go out. We walked briskly toward Father's house on Shandong Road. Outside, it was sunny and cold. The streets were deserted. There was very little traffic and few pedestrians. A truckload of soldiers in peaked caps and padded winter uniforms drove past us. "People's Liberation Army!" Aunt Wren exclaimed. "How young they are! None of these communist soldiers look over 20. I was shocked. "Is Tianjin in communist hands?" I asked in a whisper. "Has Chiang Kai-shek lost the war?" "Yes, with hardly a bullet being fired. Beijing has lost too. The nationalists simply gave up and retreated south. Didn't the sisters tell you?" "No, they never talk about the civil war. But all the girls are gone, and I am the only pupil left. Thank you for rescuing me." "It's a good thing I suddenly thought of you. You see, we've been living in your father's house for the last few months and taking care of it for him. Since we're leaving, I tried to contact your big sister to keep an eye on the house. That's when I learned she and her husband have already escaped to Taiwan." "Didn't your sister visit you to say goodbye before she left Tianjin?" "I've seen no one since I came here last September. You are my first and only visitor." "Aren't you afraid, all by yourself like this?" I heard the concern in her voice and was close to tears again. "A little." She tried to reassure me. "Everything will be fine from now on." "Where is Aunt Baba? Is she in Hong Kong too?" "No, she chose to remain in Shanghai." "Does Niang know you're taking me with you to Hong Kong?" "No, I haven't had a chance to write her." I was terrified and trembled with fear. "May I please go to Shanghai instead of Hong Kong?" I begged. "No, of course not. The communists will probably be marching into Shanghai in a few months. Oh, don't look so scared. You'll be safe in less than 3 weeks.
After lunch, we'll come back in a rickshaw and get your belongings.
What can be better than being with your parents and Yaya in their new home in Hong Kong?
I dared not reply, but thought, what can be worse? All the time, I was quaking at the thought of what Nyang would say when she saw me.
Chapter 16, Hong Kong. We three children were very excited when we walked up the gangway of the British flagship China Star and saw officers, crew, and staff rushing around. A Chinese steward led the way and helped Uncle Jean and Aunt Wren with our luggage. Victor, Claudine, and I lagged behind. The steward was tall and thin and towered over everyone. His head was completely bald, and he walked with a pronounced limp. As we followed them down a long, narrow corridor toward our cabins, all we could see was the steward's shiny scalp bobbing up and down under the dim ceiling lights. Victor whispered to me,
"One thing about having no hair at all on your head, you always look neat."
Though I was still feeling nervous and tongue-tied, because it had only been 3 days since Aunt Wren took me out of St. Joseph's, I laughed out loud. That was the effect Victor had on people. He and Claudine made me feel at ease as soon as I met them.
"Boys to the right and girls to the left," Uncle Jean said.
Our two cabins were directly opposite each other. Inside, everything was neat, bare, and clean. While Aunt Wren, Claudine, and I were unpacking, there was a knock on the door. Victor stood there, grinning from ear to ear and wearing a bright red and orange life jacket.
"Why are you wearing that?" Claudine protested. "Our ship hasn't even sailed yet."
"In case the China Star starts going down, then you'll really be sorry you're not wearing one yourself.
Here, let me show you something."
He parted the curtain and looked out of the round porthole. Our cabin was below deck. Outside, we could see nothing but deep, dark water. It did appear rather sinister and forbidding. Claudine became alarmed.
"Mama, how often does a ship sink?"
she asked. Before Aunt Wren had time to reply, Victor quipped with a straight face,
"Only once."
Aunt Wren and I could not help laughing in spite of ourselves. But then Victor did something my brothers would never have done. He took off his life jacket, slipped it on his sister, and showed her how to adjust the straps. There were only two narrow twin beds in our cabin, each covered with a dark blue bedspread tucked in tightly. At night, our steward brought in a tiny roll-out cot because there were three of us. I assumed the cot was for me. Though the mattress was thin and barely 6 inches from the floor, I didn't mind because it was a small price to pay for being rescued from the communists. I was arranging the blankets and pillow when Aunt Wren put a restraining hand on my arm.
Now, remember what I told you on your first day with us. It's share and share alike in our family. Nobody is going to be treated differently. Come, let's draw lots to decide who will sleep on the floor."
She tore a sheet of paper into three parts, wrote bed one on one, bed two on the second, and cot on the third, folded them, and placed them in a paper bag, from which we made our picks, including Aunt Wren herself. Claudine picked first, came up with cot, and slept there the entire time without protest. That was how the Schilling family treated me throughout the time I spent with them. They made me feel as if I were their third child. For the first time in my life, I did not automatically get the short end of the stick, but was given an equal share, just like Victor and Claudine.
As we steamed southward, the weather became noticeably warmer. The sea was calm, and we three children spent much time playing hide-and-seek on the decks. Once, Victor hid in a lifeboat for half an hour while we searched everywhere. Then he suddenly jumped out as we passed below him, scaring and delighting us at the same time.
"I am Sinbad the Sailor," he cried. "Don't you love the smell of the salty sea and the noise of the engines and everything about the ship?"
"What I love best is the library. Let's go there," I told them.
The library was tucked away in a quiet, secluded corner next to a sun-drenched atrium. All the books were in English. Most of them were mysteries, romances, and travel books. We browsed for a while until Victor found a stack of games. Claudine turned out to be a whiz at Monopoly. While we played, I could not help noticing how nice Victor was to his sister. Though he liked to tease her, he was gentle and protective at the same time. For long stretches of time on that voyage, as we chased each other on deck, read books in the library, played games in the atrium, or made paper cuts from the book Mother Marie had given me, I actually felt as if I were part of the Schilling family, and no longer the unwanted daughter who always came last. At night, I would fantasize about being adopted by them, belonging to them, and going off with them forever. How wonderful life would be if I did not have to face Nyong ever again. Then I would remember my true status, and my heart would be touched by ice. It could be put off no longer. The dreaded day had arrived for me to come face to face with Nyong. Our ship steamed into the dock in Hong Kong Harbor. We walked down the gangplank in search of a familiar face, but no one was there to meet us. Aunt Wren comforted me. It was so difficult to get our boat tickets, and I couldn't be sure until the very last minute. By then, it was too late to write to your parents. 2 months ago, I did send them a letter to say we were definitely coming to Hong Kong soon, but didn't know the exact date. I'll go find a telephone to tell them we're here and that you're with us, Adeline. They'll be so thrilled. Victor and Claudine groaned in unison, crushed at not being met. I breathed a sigh of relief, but quickly pretended disappointment. We hailed a taxi and squeezed in with all our luggage. Aunt Wren turned to me. "I forgot today is Sunday. We're lucky, because when I phoned your parents, I found everyone home, including your father." I sat in the taxi in silent terror. The roads were clean and traffic was orderly. Our cab trailed a tall, red, double-decker bus, which stopped at a traffic light. Claudine wound down the car window. "How hot and stuffy Hong Kong is," she said. "Look at the street signs. They're all bilingual, with English on top and Chinese at the bottom, but nothing in French." Victor answered in a superior tone. "Of course there's nothing in French. Everything has to be in English because we are on British soil. Hong Kong has been a British colony for over 100 years. It became British when China lost the Opium War. Look at the shop signs. They have English on them too." Having spent so much time together while sailing from Tianjin to Hong Kong, the three of us had become good friends. Victor addressed me. "Let's continue our Monopoly game when we get to your parents' place. On board ship, I kept losing. Maybe my luck will change here. Will you show me how to make those paper cuts and lend me that book Mother Marie gave you called Paper Magic?
What a smashing book! You think your mother will let us have some big sheets of paper so we can make fleets of airplanes and platoons of soldiers? I'll paint designs on them in 2 different colors, and we can play war games with them. Won't that be fun?
I smiled and nodded. Victor didn't know that the make-believe Nyang I talked about was very different from the real one we'd be facing. All too quickly, our cab turned into a street marked Boundary Street and stopped opposite an imposing school building. Was I to be dropped off at another school so soon? A large sign above the gate read Mary Knoll Convent School. No children were about, and the gate was closed. The cab driver asked me for his fare in Cantonese, expecting me to translate since I was the only one with a Chinese face. Aunt Wren answered him in fluent Mandarin and paid him. Regarding her with new respect, he pointed to the freshly painted 3-story apartment building next to us and helped with our luggage.
So they live opposite a girls' school, I thought. Is little sister enrolled there? How convenient for her.
Suddenly, father, Nyang, 4th brother, little sister, and 2 maids were swarming around us.
Hello, 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 welcome, welcome.
Nyang was embracing Aunt Wren and jabbering away gaily in a mixture of French and English.
We have been watching out for you from our balcony. Come in, come in.
Her greeting appeared to include me, though she neither made eye contact nor addressed me directly. Father grinned from ear to ear and warmly shook Uncle Jean's hand. 4th brother hailed Victor, and little sister was making